Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me now is Dr. Solveig Nitzke. Dr. Nitzke is a professor of comparative literature at the University of Vienna and an author. Thank you so much for being here, Solveig.
Thank you for having me, Claire.
Well, you have penned quite a few books and very intriguing topics about ferns and trees and their connectedness, I think, with us and the natural world. So I want to get into that, but first we want to learn a little bit more about you and your background and what led you to writing such pieces. So tell me a little bit about your path and how you became a literature professor first, and then what made you delve into this writing?
Oh, that is a question for the whole autobiography, but I love to answer it. So I love to tell my students about how I came to study, especially comparative literature, because I am a knowledge glutton. Basically, I wanted to study everything. And in Germany, when you're done with school, you're 19 and the whole world is open. And I took this very seriously and wanted to do all the topics at the university, literally all of them, except for like law and sports. So I tried to figure out a way to do that. And my idea, which I for a long time thought was naive, but now that I'm a professor in this topic, I think it's actually a good idea. I thought if I studied literature, I can do all the things because there is a novel about everything. And I still think that was a good idea, because what got me into plants ultimately was my interest in how knowledge is produced under precarious circumstances. So that is basically the tagline. When you do your PhD, you need these taglines. And I started out working on science fiction and catastrophes. And I wrote this book about this disaster, the Tunguska event. Nobody knows what exploded in Siberia in 1908. And I looked at the different ways in the X-Files and tons of fantasy novels and stuff like that. And I like to be able to compare things that are literary in a more strict sense, so fictional texts formed in an artistic way, with scientific and popular texts. So I looked at that. And from the catastrophes, I came to study climate and climate change. And that was very depressing topic. I don't need to tell anyone about this, especially not this summer in Europe or anywhere else in the world, to be sure. So I thought I would do a little side quest into trees. A colleague of mine wanted to do, you know, just like a teeny tiny workshop on trees. And I was like, I'm in, you can't do this without me. And then I suddenly noticed that apparently my whole life I was already thinking about trees. And the little side quest turned into the second book project, which is interesting. In Germany, you basically do a second PhD to be able to become a professor. So I needed to really decide on what I can do. And sometimes my colleagues reacted a little bit surprised, let's say, because it's not like a very typical topic for a comparative and German scholar. But I couldn't stop, and I found so many texts, and I could do what I always like to do, which is, as I said, comparing literary and non-fictional texts. And the ferns really happened in the pandemic. And I can tell you more about that, but I'm already talking so long.
I love people's paths because it tells you so much about the writings and where it's coming from and with what passion it's coming from. And it sounds like you're very passionate about these topics. Yeah. So yeah, let's get into the elegance of ferns, because we have talked about ferns on this show before and these natural wonders and how a lot of times we look at how they're formed and their design, and we utilize that as humans in our different designs and how we do things, because there's such a beauty to it. So tell me your draw to ferns and your learnings inside that world.
I was drawn to ferns because they're fundamentally weird to humans, I want to say, but especially to me. And weird, I should say, is a big compliment in my world. It's something, because, I mean, the first thing you need to do with ferns is learn how to see them. And I am a city person. I've always been drawn to non-human others more than human others, but I was never really one for, spending a night outside in the forest. But I am a person who likes to be surprised by the things she hasn't noticed yet. And ferns are perfect for that. And they are not only when you walk somewhere or you, I don't know, go through a forest and you suddenly notice that everything is full of ferns and you can't unsee them anymore. These forms, because they're so recognizable to our eyes, but they also blend so easily within like this larger green backdrop to our scenes as humans. And they are weird because they're such an old species. And this was really what intrigued me about them, the way in which it's difficult to see them and then difficult to unsee them and to not see ferns everywhere. You can't believe how much I annoyed my family by going, "Look, look, look, there's another one, there's another one." And also because they're weird, because they're kind of hiding in plain sight in our idea of natural history. Because of course we learn it and we kind of know that ferns belong to the backdrop of every dinosaur picture. But once I started looking for them, I found community not only with the plants, but also with the other people who became fern enthusiasts. So that kind of drew me in. And there is this German poet, Sabine Scholl, whom I kind of quote in the book as well. And she wrote this beautiful poem for a conference on plant studies that I was co-organizing at the time. And she pinpoints the wit of these plants. And that I really like, this idea of like plants as having their own kind of idea of how to exist in the world, that in the case of ferns, functions completely independent of human. You said that with the utilizing the form of ferns is one of the few ways in which humans are able to use ferns at all.
They also carry this great ecological force, I guess, in their ecosystems. So tell me, in your studies around them, what roles or ways in which they interact with their ecosystem that make them very valuable for an area?
I mean, that depends on which time on Earth you're talking about. If you consider them as some of the earliest complex plant forms on the land altogether, we might well say that we owe forests and our green planet to ferns, which is of course a story that a literary person would tell you. I know that a biologist or botanist might tell differently, but that is what ferns often do. They and I don't like the word colonize in that context, because I mean it is a very human-laden word, but plants basically are the first gardeners in any kind of ecosystem. If you consider landscapes in which volcanoes erupted, for example, I wrote about these Hawaiian ferns that the National Park Service is warning people about, because you can't put them in your garden. They will take over immediately because they're basically evolved to colonize, or to be the first who grow on land with cooled lava. And they are very practically the plants that profit from shadow, but also shade the forest floor, which is, again, I'm speaking from Europe, where everything's very dry this summer. And if you have a forest that is full of ferns, the chances of the forest floor being more moist and retaining water are much higher. So they are also not only symbols, but signs of a healthy forest ecosystem where you find specific fern species. You can tell something about the makeup of the forest floor, the kinds of, diversity that you can find in a forest. But it always depends on which species of fern you can find, which was interesting for me because, especially in literary texts, they often are just named fern. And it's a very different thing, like I said, if you have this Hawaiian red fern, or if you have like bracken or something that can just grow like weeds in what feels like moments and that cover a floor. If you have the de delicate maidenhair ferns that grow like under very specific conditions. So they're useful with all the caveats that word brings because of its anthropogenic nature. But they also kind of wait in ecosystems. And that is what I find so interesting, especially speaking as a human being, because although, we can't harvest them for food, really. I mean, you can eat some fern species, but it's not like wheat or anything, or apples or something that is useful in that kind of sense. But ferns are also useful as a reminder that the green world is not waiting for us to get our act together. It might just wait for us to not get our act together and then, keep growing without us, which is, as I said, I come from catastrophe and apocalypse research. I tend to notice these things, but I think it's a very interesting reminder. And also to note, I'm not a botanist, so these are the kind of stories that I draw from or tell in collaboration with ferns.
So they are these ecological marvels, really. They have this adaptability. They have been around for hundreds of millions of years, and they continue to exist like that on our planet, like you said, adapting to or moving through the world, regardless of what these volatile temperatures might do. They are something that tends to be one of the more sustainable plants in our world. And they also have this beauty, and I just have a fascination with them in so many different ways for all of the reasons that we have spoken to. And you also have delved very deeply, not only in the world of ferns, but in trees. And you have this book called Making Kin with Trees, A Cultural Poetics of Interspecies Care. And I'd love for you to walk us through your investigations around relationship to trees, and what are some of your more unique findings?
So this book is part of a research project of roughly the same name that I conducted, and the German book that has a very similar name. I look at the relationships of trees and humans in literary texts. And so the pragmatic reason for the English-speaking or English-language book to exist is that there is so much research on how trees and humans interact, especially in like very recent texts like Richard Powers's The Overstory or Annie Proulx's Barkskins and texts like this, that the unique findings that are present in Making Kin with Trees are focusing on the practices in which especially nonfiction texts engage with the relationship of humans and trees. So if you want to kind of get an idea of the corpus or the text that I'm talking about, it's mostly nonfiction, reaching from Peter Wohlleben's The Hidden Life of Trees and Finding the Mother Tree by Suzanne Simard and Robin Wall Kimmerer. And I look at how practitioners and scientists find ways of talking about trees once they have kind of discovered. There's always this kind of discovery scene that the language of their specific profession is not enough to express what trees are, do, and how we relate to them. So I look, for example, at the role of reading in the relationship between humans and trees, and that is special insofar as in the field I'm coming from, eco-criticism or the environmental humanities, or if you think of something like nature writing, this idea of having an authentic and direct relationship to the more than human other is lauded and hailed. And I'm pretty sure I don't need to tell you that, because the whole idea of like spending time in national parks and in wilderness relies on this idea of authenticity. And I want to make an argument that reading about something or finding a way to trees, as I did, for example, through reading about them, is no less authentic or direct, but actually helps in what Anand Singh calls the arts of noticing, because you are confronted both with language and with the natural being, if you want to call it that. So you always have to consider that you are approaching, for example, a tree as a human. And this approach I take very literally, because I start with the question whether or not I am a tree hugger and what being a tree hugger means as a scholar. And this is the main argument and the main finding of the book, that going through reading and seeing and sensing and knowing and communicating about and with trees rests on the fact that you need to take or find a stance towards trees, again, very literally, and find a way to position yourself, especially as a researcher, no matter what field you're coming from, toward trees, because it's not something that can be encompassed by just trying to be objective or neutral or talking about facts, but it's also feelings and sensory, impressions rather than expressions, and how you relate and how you actively work on this relationship. And I mean, the cool thing about academic books is that you can't spoil them. But what I want to work on, and I can't do that alone, as kind of a new mythology of human tree relationships. So how we talk about trees, how we reflect on our own ways of talking about trees. And I say this because it's so important, especially in like dry summers, when people reduce trees to, which is important, to like, you know, practical shade givers in cities and like cheap helpers in the fight against climate change, where you go like, but they're also beings, and there are beings that we can fundamentally not understand. And that is what's so interesting for me, besides the fact that I'm kind of reading popular science books wrong, because they're not addressed to me as a literary scholar. Of course, I know that, but looking at the kind of stories, the kinds of myths, and not as in opposed to lie, but myth as in like a mythological tale that explains to us how we are in the world. And exactly the how trees kind of refuse to be fully understood by humans is something that I think can be appreciated, and that is more kind of a call than, or a claim than a finding. I hope to contribute to this appreciation of trees as trees and not something that is mainly useful to us.
Right. And that nods to that title, Make Kin with the Trees. And you're very much working around this anthropomorphism and speaking to them in different terms to have us better understand them as maybe cohorts in this world. You know, I just said, what is a job for a fern in an ecosystem? It's not always assigning them a task, but it's allowing them to be a part of the natural world as we are.
Exactly. And it's like trying to find a way of making kin that does not require trees or plants in general to become more human, so to anthropomorphize them. I don't need them to talk to me or to dance or to connect. I don't even need them to communicate in any way I can understand. But as the plant philosopher Michael Martyr puts it, to, and I'm not quoting here, I can't quote that from memory, but to make kin with trees basically means that you need to find a way to become more tree. And since that is something that is bound to fail, is what I add to Michael Martyr's things, we need a kind of humility in working with and relating to trees that has become, or maybe always was, rare. And when I say has become or always was rare, I'm speaking as a European, accepting ourselves as you said, being part of the natural world seems difficult enough, but really dealing with the fact that we need to appreciate others that we will not understand or control is a huge task, but I also think it's a very rewarding one because, like you said, with the ferns, it makes the world so much more interesting and mysterious. You don't even need the fairies under the ferns and the trees anymore because the trees and the ferns themselves become so wondrous.
Well, our time here is coming to an end, but I did want to see if there's a website or a way that people can learn more about your writings and you and find your books.
Hopefully, the website of the University of Vienna will be up soon. Other than that, it's mostly easy to Google my name. That's the good thing about the special name. And I'm active on Instagram and Blue Sky, and I have a blog, ecologies.hypotheses.org, that I will need to revive soon. But you can
Well,
find me basically everywhere.
you have very wonderful, unique writing. The first book we talked about was The Elegance of Ferns, and then the one that is just coming out is Making Kin with Trees, that came out in 2025. So we appreciate you so much for being a part of This Green Earth and providing your perspective for us. It's Dr. Solveig Nitzsche. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me and the wonderful questions.